It seems only yesterday, Ron, that we were in Paris, hooting, hollering, even fighting. Why, I even remember pulling one gentleman's hat down over his ears. How in the world they finished that infernal performance, I'll never know. But now it's 100 years. That's 100 years of Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Kidding aside, I'm James Baker, and I'm joined by Ron Moore to talk a bit about Stravinsky's bold and controversial score, how it came to be made, and how history has treated it. We will also sample some recordings of the work and make some recommendations, purely subjective, as such things almost always are. Le Sacre du Printemps, commonly known as the Rite of Spring, was written for the 1913 season of Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. The famous near riot took place on the occasion of the first performance in the Champs-Élysées Theater on May 29, 1913. Hundredth anniversary of Rite of Spring coming up in about 10 days, I guess, officially. We've been thinking about it for a good year or so because it is monumental in a way, the importance. It's a landmark of contemporary classical music, don't you think?
Yes, I do. And Bernstein went so far as to say, and we'll, I guess, talk a little bit more about Bernstein and his relationship to the Rite of Spring, said that he thought it was the great composition of the 20th century. And what I do feel now, after thinking about it again and listening to all these versions, some of which we're going to talk about, is that if it's true that the Ninth Symphony is in many ways kind of the song or hymn of mankind, I think then the Rite of Spring really is maybe the great dance of humanity and is something even greater than people perhaps realize.
And yet, Ron, you still see criticism of the Rite of Spring. There are a lot of people who you would think, we're 100 years past this. Why are people still debating whether this is really a significant piece of contemporary music? Is it really a great piece of music? And the debate still rages on. It amazes me that it has this, that the debate has this kind of lasting power.
Well, I think that part of it is something that I discovered really only when we decided that we were going to do this particular approach to the Rite of Spring to talk about it. And that is that I think if you've never seen the ballet, if you've only heard concert music or seen concert music, part of it is that's not the Rite of Spring. And that the Rite of Spring that people freaked out about in Paris and the Rite of Spring of myth is something that was a strange conjunction of accident and history and opportunity and the work of a collection of geniuses, at the center of which was Stravinsky.
So whenever we think about it as a ballet, you're saying that it's a collective. Whenever we think about it as an orchestral score, is it still, does it still bring that collection of sources to the stage?
No, not for me. I think that the concert piece is something else again, and that this thing that he worked on forever, the Rite of Spring and its concert versions, are in a way two different works. And I'd even say that beyond that, the piano version, which I think hopefully we'll hear some of, is yet a third work. And all three of them together give you kind of a, I guess, something of a gestation, a growth, and then the different facets of a Rite of Spring. Maybe it's even fair to talk about it as being several works.
Well, let's back up just a moment and discuss how Stravinsky came to music, and did he come through a traditional conservatory route, or exactly how did he come into this world of music?
Well, you know, it's really one of those funny things. And once again, if you look at some of the biographies and articles on Stravinsky, you have this idea that he's like this autodidact who came fully grown to the world, and then after a few lessons with Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, began to write this extraordinary series of ballets. And it's really not the truth at all. The fact of the matter was he came from one of the great musical households of 19th century Russia. His father was a premier singer at the Mariinsky Theater. His mother sang and played the piano. And he had his father's huge library of scores and biographies at his fingertips. Their apartment in St. Petersburg put him within walking distance of the Mariinsky Theater, so he went to the opera, to the ballet, and to the symphony the way you and I go to the movies. And that's the kind of household he grew up in. The people that came through his home and who were friends of his family, and particularly the musicians known to his father, beyond the early piano lessons given by his mother, on again, off of him, gave him an ongoing informal education that culminates finally in the great lessons with Rimsky-Korsakov at the end. So he was tutored. He didn't go to conservatory, but even that's kind of a joke, because after he showed a piano sonata and some other work to Rimsky-Korsakov, Rimsky-Korsakov told him he should study privately with him because he thought he'd be bored at conservatory.
So I guess if we were really looking at his resume, however, we would see the formal part of his resume would show not studying music at all, but as every good musical father and parents always insist of their children, don't do like I did. Don't invest yourself in music. Do something sensible. Become a doctor or a lawyer.
You're absolutely right. This was the really comic part. He always wanted to be a musician, but the family really put their foot down about it, particularly his father, who had lived that life to its end point and knew how difficult it was. And so all his life, he has this, I mean, he has great formal education. He goes to St. Petersburg. He goes to law school. The comic part is he's kind of freed at the end of his career, and he doesn't get to graduate from law school because the revolution's coming, and there's all this. It's kind of like the 60s, but it's in Russia. And what happens is they shut down the law school, so he's finally free to just study and write music.
Just a few words, Ron, about Stravinsky's relationship with Rimsky-Korsakov, because I think it's an important clue to Stravinsky's startling mastery of the orchestra. Now, was it Stravinsky who approached Rimsky, or did Rimsky recruit Stravinsky to study with him?
A little bit of each. Sort of what happened was that in this long arc of studying piano and studying counterpoint and going to the theater and hearing voices and writing early songs, he wrote some keyboard music, the early sonata. And this was the piece, along with a few other songs, that he showed to Rimsky-Korsakov. His father had known Rimsky-Korsakov because he'd sung in his operas. He was friends with Rimsky-Korsakov's son. And while they were both at a spa, I think, in Germany, there was dinner, and his compositions came up, and he asked, would Rimsky-Korsakov take a look? And Rimsky-Korsakov did. And he really wanted to know if he thought he should go to conservatory. And as you say, so he says, well, Rimsky-Korsakov says, well, you know, this is interesting. I don't know that you should go to conservatory. I think you'd find it very boring. I'll be happy to take you on as a private student. And so, as you say, you've got this law student by day and this crazy composer by night and in the summertime. And this is when he has his real musical education. And what I've always found funny is something you just said, which is that you would never dream in this early piano sonata or his early orchestral music that Stravinsky is in there.
Well, it's interesting that the thing that we always think of with Rimsky-Korsakov is his skill at orchestration. And you would think that that would be the thing that Rimsky would see in Stravinsky. He would want to lead him in the direction of orchestration. And yet the first music of Stravinsky that he examined had nothing to do with an orchestra.
That's right. Along the lines of what you're saying, the point of departure seems to be a funny thing happened in the period of this time of his studying with Rimsky-Korsakov. There's a secondary concert series, much like in Vienna, the Society of Contemporary Music. There's a parallel of that in St. Petersburg. There's a group that gets together on again, off again, of avant-garde people from the different arts, from painting, from theater, from journalism, and they go to a series of concerts of modern music. And it's at these concerts that Stravinsky first meets Sergei Diaghilev, who runs the Ballet Russe, because being given at one of these concerts is what we all think of, I guess, as one of the earliest of Stravinsky's really significant pieces, and that's Fireworks.
And Fireworks was something that I assume that I think really shows the influence of the master orchestrator Rimsky-Korsakov.
Exactly, exactly. You have the culmination of the lessons and the fact that he's absorbed the art of orchestration, but you can see as early as the Firebird that it's going to be a hop, skip, and a jump from being the pupil to some kind of master of his own that's completely different than the man that gave him lessons, as you often point out about so many great composer teachers.
Let's hear a little bit of Fireworks just to get an idea of Stravinsky beginning to give us an idea of the great orchestrator that he would become as a result of his studies with Rimsky-Korsakov. Igor Stravinsky's Fireworks, a work which came of the period when he studied with Rimsky-Korsakov as well, it precedes not only The Rite of Spring, but also the Firebird Ballet. That performance, by the way, was with Seiji Ozawa conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, dated 1968. And I thought as long as we've got this queued up, it might be interesting to hear a bit of a 1968 recording of Rite of Spring, again with Ozawa and the Chicago Symphony. This would have been very early in Seiji's career, before Boston. He guest-conducted the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and they liked him very much. As a result, he had a nice affiliation with the orchestra at their summer home in Ravinia, and this also enabled Ozawa to make a number of very good recordings with Chicago. I find this recording of Sakura interesting, though we find both Ozawa and the orchestra still finding their way with the score. Surprisingly, Chicago only played the Rite once with Fritz Reiner, and it wasn't even a performance at the orchestra's downtown home of Orchestra Hall. Anyhow, here's the Procession of the Wise Elders, giving an opportunity to hear the Chicago brass and, coincidentally, a very young principal horn player named Dale Clevenger. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Seiji Ozawa from a recording made in 1968. You would think at this point that any of the major orchestras would be familiar with the score of The Rite of Spring and able to play it at a very high level, but I found interesting a comment by Pierre Boulez saying, "That work is extremely important to me," referring to Sakura, "but it was rarely performed, even in my student days. One performance I heard then with Charles Munch, the sacrificial dance that closes the second part, was as if both the players and the conductor were driving on ice. Neither were convinced." And, Ron, I think that describes a lot of the performances from that period, which is to say just after the Rite of Spring celebrated its 50th anniversary. Now, if you'll bear with me, this seems a good time to hear a little bit of another recording of the Rite with Chicago again, this time coming during the tenure of Sir George Scholte. You'd expect this to be a really good match of conductor and music, since there was always something a little primitive about Scholte, and I say that in a complimentary way. Also, the orchestra had matured somewhat after the Ozawa recording we just heard. Here's that same section, just for comparison. So George Schulte and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra playing an excerpt from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. There's really a lot to recommend about this recording, one which has been off and on out of print, but is now included in the collector's edition just put out by Decca of 40 recordings. Yes, count them, 40 recordings over 20 discs of the Rite of Spring. This, of course, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first performance back in 1913.